Welcome to another episode of Side Hustle City, the podcast that helps you turn your side hustle into your main hustle, with your hosts, Adam Kaler and Kyle Stevie. All right, guys, welcome back to the Side Hustle City podcast. And once again, Kyle Stevie.
Hello.
How you doing, Kyle?
Excellent.
Excellent. All right. And as always, Kyle has to rush right out of here after our podcast and go back to work.
Well, no, I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
I won't say on what, but that's part of my side hustle fun stuff.
There you go.
Workday is done. Now I got to just get it done by the end of the month.
Yeah, well, see, more side hustles. Kyle's trying a lot of things. Anyway, so
you got to.
So, guys, we got a special guest for you today, Andrew Kerr. Andrew runs a podcast himself, the House Hacking Podcast. And I think you just told us before we started here that it's in the top 5% of all podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, we've just been absolutely killing it on the downloads. I feel really fortunate. You know, I just started as a way to help folks. And then all of a sudden, the like weekly downloads just started climbing up like 10% a week, 20% a week. And it's just absolutely, you know, blown up. So it's really awesome. And I feel fortunate that we have that big reach to help folks.
That's great. And what do you attribute that to? What do you think happened? Like, was it, what triggered it?
Ah, man, some of it was, you know, we had some really great guests on that had some really killer stories. I mean, we had one woman that just sort of shared about how she used house hacking to broaden her financial sort of foundation and then get into real estate investing. And then she got a breast cancer diagnosis, and she literally attributed to the reason I had the financial resources to battle breast cancer was, you know, because of what I did with house hacking. And, you know, we just had great folks like that that came on and share their story. And it wasn't all glamorous. There was bad parts to it as well. And people just seemed to love that of like, hey, they're a real person. They did it. They share their successes, their challenges, a lot to learn from it. So yeah, a lot of it is not me as the host. It's the great guests we've had on.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. We had a WWE guy on the other day. A couple, 3 weeks ago, maybe?
Barry, yeah.
Yeah, Barry. And he was telling us how he went from being a, you know, a kid in a farm town in Wales, UK, to somehow coming to America with his wrestling talents. I think he was a rugby guy, right?
I'm not sure what he played.
I think he said he played rugby. He was 6'5", like
soccer too.
300 pounds. And, you know, I mean, there's, you know, obviously you're going to play sports when you're that big, yeah. But he came to the United States and just started getting into wrestling down in Florida. And next thing you know, he's a professional wrestler in the WWE fighting John Cena, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is pretty awesome. And then for whatever reason, he got into real estate, and I thought that was a really cool story. But yeah, I mean,
he's getting big into it too. He's teaming up with a lot of different groups I've seen in terms of just getting into like joint ventures and beyond his own holdings and syndications.
It's pretty awesome. So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about what you're doing right now and then maybe a little bit about how you got here.
Yeah, sure. So I spend my time doing nonprofit work. We used to do a lot of traveling before this global pandemic thing sort of stopped that. But I and my wife now do real estate investing and a lot in the house hacking niche of real estate investing to sort of give us our financial base so we can go out and do what we love, which is, you know, nonprofit work. For the past decade, it's been aid work, humanitarian work around the world. And now over the past year and a half has been helping support a branch of the military through a foundation and helping support fallen heroes and doing morale and wellness initiatives and education stuff. But, you know, it's all just real estate to power what I'm doing, and what I love is that nonprofit work.
Oh, wow. What got you into the military stuff? Did either one of you two serve?
No, I almost did. This was back in high school. I wanted to, I took the ASVAB, and I got like almost a perfect score. I was ready going to go into the Marines soon as I graduated, and a little bit of a mama's boy. My mom freaked out and said, no, you can't do that. You're going to go off the war. So I didn't go that route, but tons of my family did. My brother was an MP in the Army. So we, you know, even my sister and brother-in-law were not Army, but police officers. So I just had this big affinity for you know, what we have in our country and the folks that volunteer to serve in the military. And after doing all this international work, I was like, really had this desire to do something more back at home here in the U.S. and had this great opportunity where a nonprofit reached out to come and work with them. And I just couldn't say no.
Wow. That's awesome. So what's your background? Where do you come from? And it sounds like you're living in New Orleans now. New Orleans, right?
How do you say it?
New Orleans, you know, little different depending on the mood that you're in and maybe how many drinks you've had that day. You might say it's slightly different.
Because now we're close to Louisville, and you say Louisville, you don't say Louisville. And they get pretty upset with you, actually.
Yeah.
People up here still say Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Instead of Cincinnati for either, there's like no A, but you know, they say Cincinnati. So where were you from originally?
Yeah. So my dad was an IBM guy for pretty much his whole career. You know, I was born out in California. Then we grew up in North Carolina, and that was pretty much always home is North Carolina. But you know, I was one of those kids in high school that if I liked a class, I got an A, and it wasn't like barely an A. It was like 98, 99, almost 100. And then the classes I didn't like, or I didn't like the teacher, I basically got a D. I did enough to get by and pass. And there's really no middle grounds. There's no C's. It was either A's or D's. And that caused me not to go to college and just end up trying to start working right away. And that ended up having sort of my first early career in the mortgage industry back in North Carolina. And, you know, by 20, I'd already bought my own home, and by 23 was a partner in a mortgage company. And that was sort of the fast track of life that I was on.
What year was that?
Oh man, I started 2001, 2002 up until 2008. So it was a great time to be in the mortgage business.
Oh yeah.
What happened in 2008?
Well, that was a crash.
Oh, you know, this
yeah.
little.
Oh, little oh you're being.
Crash. I'm being very sarcastic.
Yeah. What happened in 2008? Yeah, well then a lot of people got out of it, especially those like shady brokers.
Oh yeah!
All there were so many. It's like everybody and their mom owned a mortgage brokerage back then, and all of a sudden they all started going away. And you know, where'd they go? You know, fly by night mortgage place. But
so did you see that happening? Did you see that your competition was starting to get super saturated with people that you didn't think were as reputable as they should have been?
I wish I was smart and had that foresight, but you know, a 20 years old, you don't, you know, I was 20 years old, you know, making 10-12 grand commission checks every month. And that's what caused me to buy my first home. But when I started, you actually didn't need a license. And then North Carolina was one of the early states that started adopting a license. I think it was like 2003, 2004. And then, you know, ended up getting licensed. That cut out a lot of folks that were shady or had really bad backgrounds. And then it was sort of after the 08 crisis is when, you know, they had that national mortgage license system sort of went into place. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of shady folks in there. There's a lot of things you could do in like California that weren't allowed in North Carolina. There's a lot more sort of predatory lending laws in place in North Carolina. So we were fortunate where we didn't really see that many unscrupulous people in there compared to some other states. But yeah, man, it was a wild time to be in the mortgage industry.
Oh, I bet a lot of ups and downs. And I mean, now I've got a buddy. I was actually just on the phone with him because I had a bank looking at a refi for me, actually two refis that I'm trying to do right now. And they would only look at the income on my Schedule C. You know, the goal every year is to, you know, write things off. You go out and you buy a new computer at the end of the year or whatever you got to do, knowing that you're going to need this stuff so that you can drop your taxable income. And everybody does it. But the downside of that is when you try to go get an FHA mortgage or anything else, the bank says, yeah, well, if you're going to, or the government says, if you say you make this much, we're going to believe you. This is how much you make. So we're only going to look at your Schedule C. At least one bank did. Now there's other banks out there, I think, that are going to look at your Schedule E because I've got several companies and rental properties and things like that. But they would only look at the Schedule C at this one bank. And I wanted to use them because interest rates were great. So I called my buddy today. He says, man, I'm catching up with him. I went to high school with him. And he's telling me, he's like, man, I'm killing it right now. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, I made $100,000 last month.
Wow.
He's got a team now. You know, he started out around the same time you did, 2006, 2007, I think he started, you know, and he did really well. And obviously 2008 went downhill, but he stuck with it. And he's really built up his book. He's got a lot of, you know, people working for him now. and you know, he's doing great, you know, so he's going to see what he can do for me. But, you know, that's just, you know, right now with interest rates being as low as they are and, you know, nobody's selling, everybody's kind of refinancing right now. Yeah. And I'm guessing what's driving that is maybe COVID, like even people that maybe lost their jobs or well, I guess you can't really refi if you don't have a job, but you know, people were doing it just to kind of have a little cash in the bank just in case things happen, you know?
Money is all around us and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that a lot of people gave a lot of flack for it was like the ninja loans or the NINA loans, like the no income, no asset, as long as your credit score was great. The loan was actually, the purpose of the loan was perfect. It was for that business owner that would actually make a couple hundred grand a year, but had an amazing accountant and would show they only actually cleared, you know, for tax purposes, 20 grand a year. So they couldn't qualify for a loan. And that NINA loan was perfect for folks like that. It just ended up getting abused and then essentially gone away. And I mean, unfortunately, isn't that the way a lot of things work? It's meant for a specific purpose. Then people abuse it or find a way to hack it and take advantage of it. And then the system changes. But yeah, I mean, you're very right. As a business owner, even a real estate investor, we want to use our depreciation. We can do things like cost seg studies to pull forward depreciation to try to make us we're paying as little tax as possible.
We got some people that are brand new. Is there any way you can explain what cost seg is?
Yeah. So I guess an easy way to explain it is with real estate or really any assets you buy for a business, the IRS says, you know, you can depreciate this over so many years. So say you have a piece of land with a building on it and the building's worth, for easy math, $27,500. The IRS will say you can deduct this and depreciate this over a 27 and a half year period. So you're basically getting $1,000 a year. A cost seg study basically is a process where you go in and you say, okay, yeah, the IRS says here's the standard, but we're actually going to break apart the building into all these different pieces. And while the roof might only be good for a smaller period of time, so it's basically a process, accounting process, and an engineering review process that splits apart the building into pieces, and then you reallocate the depreciation. So instead of having that depreciation over almost 30 years, you can accelerate it forward and do a lot of it over a single year, 3 years, or 5 years. So, you know, we did one on one of my properties in 2019, you know, it gave us a $90,000 write-off in that year because we were able to pull forward depreciation. So it's a really, really cool tool that's available for real estate investors.
Yeah, and it was really crazy. I mean, if you buy a computer, I think depreciates over 5 years. Yeah. But if that computer's plugged into a wall in your office, now all of a sudden, like that wall or that room or something can be depreciated over 5 years because you have a 5-year depreciated asset and you need that wall and that plug in order to run that computer and do your business.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it's pretty wild.
Our tax code is set up for some pretty, pretty cool stuff in. You know, you got to learn to take advantage of it. I mean, you guys might have seen it, but maybe it was like 2 years ago, back when Amazon was looking at going into Brooklyn and they were talking about how they didn't have any, you know, taxes that year because they've been carrying forward a loss for several years. And, you know, you can get mad at Amazon, but it was Congress that wrote those laws. So, you know, I sort of look at it, if it's there, take advantage of it. And it's a great way to get ahead as you're a small business owner, is to get a good accountant to help you figure that stuff out.
Yeah, you'd be crazy not to.
And it's not like you don't have to pay the recapture tax when you sell the asset, right? I mean, you still get taxed. That's the thing that doesn't get talked about when you, like they were, Biden was trying to say, we're going to revamp how real estate, you know, profits are done and how tax quote unquote evasions you know, conducted by real estate professionals, and we're not going to allow for any accelerated depreciation, and the 1031 exchange is gone and all this other stuff. And it's like, dude, you need to incentivize people to own property, particularly residential property. And they still pay taxes. Eventually, I have a friend that has done very, very well. He's at the point now where he can't 1031 anything because he can't find anything worth buying after he sells his property. So he's going to make a killing when he sells, but he can't find anything that's of like kind or more expensive that's worth buying into. It's either the compressed cap rates or something that's stupid. It makes no sense to put your money into.
We had the same problem. I've done two 1031 exchanges, and the last one we did, it ended up failing out because we rolled the money into the 1031 exchange thinking I could find a replacement property, and I never could. And then we ended up just getting the money back and paying taxes on it. And, you know, I don't mind, you know, paying taxes is a good problem in one sense, where if you pay a lot of taxes, it means you made really good money. But, you know, when we did the cost seg study, all that depreciation that we had pulled forward, it saved us a ton of money on taxes. But, you know, I didn't go out and buy a Ferrari. We used that to reinvest in a new property and, you know, invest in our community. And a lot of small and medium businesses, when they have those tax advantages, it goes into hiring someone new or buying a new facility or buying a new vehicle for their business. So yeah, there's, I think, definitely a lot of misconceptions around it. And there's those few ultra, ultra wealthy that get a hard time about it. But those tax laws are great for a lot of sort of small, medium-sized businesses that are trying to grow and get ahead.
See, and another one is the opportunity zones.
Yeah.
I was talking on Facebook, which was a huge mistake.
Yes.
I don't know why I keep getting sucked into it. I know why. I love to argue. But if I didn't love to argue, I shouldn't do it.
He's a lawyer, by the way. And
Non-practicing. I pay the Kentucky Bar Association's active fee because they won't allow you to be inactive like Ohio will, a bunch of money grubbers. But what I was going to say is that I linked to the article about AOC was trying to do away with opportunity zones. I was like, what is she talking about? She has no idea what they even are. There's nothing in the article that really explains the benefit of them. And then somebody in our little chat said, well, what about this one? And some place in Florida held marked the marina as an opportunity zone. So they cherry picked one point was confirmation bias. As I've learned this term during COVID, confirmation bias. Yeah. And I'm like, no, you don't understand what this is doing in urban areas. You can't just be a slumlord. You are going in there. And so if you're in New Orleans, right, and somebody wants to buy a house that's in a mapped opportunity zone, excuse me, for simple math, if they buy a $100,000 house and they want to take advantage of the tax savings from the Opportunity Zone Fund or Opportunity Zone, first they got to create an Opportunity Zone Fund for the investment. Then on top of that, they have to buy the house for $100,000 and put what it amounts to is that you have to put the same amount of money into improvements in that property.
Yeah.
So you put $100,000 into a $100,000 property. And then you have to hold it, your money in the fund for 10 years. Now, you don't have to hold that house for 10 years, but you can't take the profits from the sale of that house. You've got to transfer it over into another property in an opportunity zone or a business that operates out of that opportunity zone. And what I didn't understand was, and why they didn't communicate this better, is that why wouldn't you want to incentivize people to invest in these areas? And if you're going to invest in these areas, and you really care about the area they're investing in, why wouldn't you want them to have to hold their money in that area so that they're not going around and flipping it or just if it's just a gentrification project or it's they're actually invested in your community because for the next decade, you know, you're their tenant, you're their client, their customer, whatever it is. Like it creates this relationship and it's been so like ill
demonized.
Reported. Yeah, just weird.
It's been demonized, but I think part of it is because of gentrification. Like you said the word, and people are afraid of gentrification. They're afraid of what's going to happen. They're saying, oh, well, these people are going to come in. They're going to build these things. They're going to spend all this money, but nobody's going to be able to afford to live there anymore.
Well, to your point, they have a sound argument. I mean, people are getting displaced from it. So the question is how do you keep affordable housing in the area where you know, inside of these opportunity zones.
Well, that's the problem in Cincinnati right now that we're dealing with is that there's a big building going up downtown. And honestly, there's nothing in it now. I mean, it's an empty shell. Nobody lives in there.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some squatters or something live in there. But they're going in there. They're fixing it up. And, you know, I talked to the mayor and he said, hey, look, you know, we need more people living downtown. Like when you have people that have money who are living downtown, they're going to spend that money. And they're going to spend that money with small businesses. You know, there might be a little restaurant or a bodega or something downstairs. These people that live upstairs, they're going to come down there. They're going to shop, right? And you're going to have economic activity in the neighborhood. It's going to help everybody, right? And if there's nobody living there now, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that the affordable housing folks want a portion of that building to be affordable housing units. And I'm not sure what their definition of affordable housing is, but that doesn't mean we're going to move homeless people in here, right? Yeah. It just doesn't. I mean, if you got people paying market rate, you know, $2,600 a month or whatever to live in an apartment, you know, I think it was $1,600 to $2,400 a month. That's not what they're paying $2,400 a month for, right? And I mean, you could build smaller units potentially that cost less money. But are the people that they're talking about still going to be able to afford to even live in a smaller unit in that building? Probably not, because it's still going to be $1,000 a month. So it's a weird argument. But in my experience, a lot of the people who complain about this don't have any skin in the game.
Well, no, they're not.
I mean, and that's the way with it is everything, right? The people that sometimes complain the loudest about anything don't really have any skin in it. And you know, you're right in this sense, right? If you want an area to improve, money has to come in. And I look at it as, you know, I've done affordable housing from a private investment side. I've done community development from the nonprofit side. If you want an area to improve, you got to have time and money, resources go into it. And that money can come from three places. The government, come from private money like you, me, individual investors, or it can come from a nonprofit. And nonprofits get their money from government grants and private foundations, corporate partnerships, and individual investors. So you got to have this sort of three-prong approach of like public, private, and nonprofit money makes this really good blend where you can avoid gentrification and if you're thoughtful about it. But even then, it's still going to take money to fix up a place. So things are always going to change, unfortunately. And you just got to try to find that right balance. But no matter what you do, there's always going to be someone on one side that's wrong or upset about it.
Yeah, there's always going to be those people. And I mean, from a developer's standpoint, you're trying to maximize the amount of money per square foot you can get for any project.
Yeah.
And you're just not going to just be a nice person to be a nice person. It's not your call because you've got investors who want to make money. This isn't like, hey, investors, sorry, I know I told you we'd be making this much money per square foot, but you know, the affordable housing thing and I got to move some, you know, people in here. They don't care about that. They want to make money, right? And if you want to do it, that's if you want to do another project, right? Yeah. If you want to be a good guy and do whatever, then okay. But your job is to make as much money as you can per square foot and then get as many tax incentives as you possibly can from whatever, you know, municipality that you're at. And I think one of the big arguments is, well, if we're giving these people tax incentives, they're saving all of this money. So why can't they invest in affordable housing? And, you know, I think you got to take that on a case-by-case basis. I don't think you can say that for, you know, every project. Hey, every project should include affordable housing units. But I mean, there's always going to be, you know, if you're going to put affordable housing in there, they're going to be smaller.
You know, I have the idea because we were talking about this earlier about technology and real estate and the trends and the way that things potentially could go. I'm under the feeling that eventually you're going to be able to own shares of affordable housing properties, but they're going to treat them like municipal bonds in a way that you get 3%. Tax-free growth on this property. You can write it off as a charitable donation. You can do things to incentivize not the developer, but the investor, so that investors are willing to put their money in there because they know that it's almost guaranteed to grow at a tax-free rate. You can maybe twist it, maybe combine it, like I was saying, with like a charitable donation and, you know, at year 10, you can get out.
I mean, we wrote a white paper on this a little bit. I mean, if you... You know, one of the things I have an idea, and I don't know, Andrew, maybe you can throw your two cents in, but one of my things is, and I know you've done Section 8 and you've been an affordable housing landlord in the past, right? And I have too for 15 years. And one of my things is I just noticed, you know, after 15 years of this is these people never get out of that cycle of poverty because you're just giving them free stuff and you're also incentivizing them to stay poor. Because if they get married and they have an additional income in the house, they could lose their Section 8. They could lose their food stamps. You know, the more kids they have and luck, you know, if those kids have some sort of disability, you're getting an SSI check on top of that. So you're incentivizing the wrong things right now for people in order to get them out of poverty. And I don't necessarily think the solution is to, you know, find developers that are going to build affordable housing in these, you know, luxury units. I think we need to stop renting for people. We need to just buy them houses. I mean, if you think about it, I've got a house. It's $1,100 a month over on the west side of Cincinnati. That's what I get for it from Section 8. But it's a $150,000 house. If the government was to just buy that house and maybe get a mortgage through, you know, maybe they give the mortgage to themselves, you know? I mean, think about it. I mean, they print the money. So, but $500 a month, $600 a month would be the mortgage on that. So now you're saving the taxpayer $500, $600 a month. You set aside maybe $100 or $200 a month per house for, you know, upkeep. And you're still saving the taxpayer money. But now what you're doing is, and these are called housing choice voucher program, right? That's what it's called, the housing choice. But it's not really a choice. Like in Cincinnati, there's like five or six neighborhoods you can actually move to because those are the neighborhoods where the property values are the lowest and investors can afford to buy those and move people in, right? So then all you do is you've concentrated poverty once again in these neighborhoods. So if you really want to give people housing choice, give them a voucher to go buy something. Yeah. They can go wherever they want. Wherever there's a house for sale and go buy something, then you spread the poverty out. You move these people into these neighborhoods where, you know, the average income's $120,000 a year or something, and out of the neighborhoods where the average income's $25,000 a year. So now their kids grow up in a better environment around other people instead of everyone they know being poor, right? And you, in order for them to get equity, their kids have to graduate high school. You know, they have to graduate college. The kids have to get certain grade point average. You know, these kind of things, you get more equity in the home. We're not just going to buy you a house and that's it. There has to be a something tied to it, right? Because you and I, we go out and buy a house and then we're like, hey, why did this person just get a free house? Oh, well, there's all these incentives they have to hit in order to do that. That way we can cut out the cycle of poverty and then their kids no longer are poor. Their kids have broken that cycle. Because those incentives were tied to successes that they could get, and they were also didn't have to grow up around a bunch of thugs, right? Now they can actually be successful, and that breaks that cycle of poverty for that family because unfortunately, a lot of demographics in this country have, in a way, been kept poor by where they live and these incentive programs.
There's sort of two things there. Like one, you know, I'm a big believer in we should have some sort of social safety net. You don't want to do everything for people. You know, you want to give them a hand up, but part of it is our social safety net is broken, right? I mean, you really touched on it is all of a sudden, hey, if you're making $30,000 a year, you get access to all these benefits. You go out, you improve yourself, you get a better job, or you get a little education or a training certificate. Now you're making $35,000, you just lost all these benefits. So it's easier in life to stay at that lower rung because the government is saying, hey, you get these benefits if you're at this level. It should be this, you know, great. Hey, you went out and got a certificate. Cool. We're going to let you keep having the benefits to help get you to 40 and then get you to 45 and then get you to 50 and then get you to 60. Okay. And now we'll start phasing out the benefits. So you're a productive member of society. So, I mean, some of it is the broken sort of social safety net in the country. You know, and the other thing, there's been a rise of sort of social impact funds and then certified B Corps. I think there's investors, you know, there's some investors that'll say, look, it's all about the bottom line, but there's this wave out there that's been growing over the past decade of folks that'll say, you know, I don't want to invest in a gun company or, hey, I can make a 15% IRR investing in this fund or this development is going to have a mix of affordable housing, middle income housing, but it's only going to get me a 12% IRR. You know, some folks will say, cool, that has a social good impact for it. So I don't mind making that. And it's a couple points less, as long as it's still meeting my minimum investment target. Not everyone's going to do that. And it also depends on the stage of your life. Like, you know, when I was in my late 20s, I took way more risk with my real estate investing than I do now in my late 30s and I'm married. So I think some of it is too, is just you can attract investment to do social good. And a lot more folks are really interested in that, but they're still going to look for a return. They're not going to say, great, here's just my money. You don't have to do anything with it. Even folks that give large checks to nonprofits, they're looking for a return in impact. So it may not be a dollar return, but you know, someone that writes a $25,000 donation to a nonprofit, you know, they might invest $250,000 in a syndication. They'll most likely won't ever put $250,000 into a nonprofit. They're different thresholds, but they might say, hey, I'll put $250,000 into this syndication deal and make that 10 or 12% versus the 15 or 16 or 17% because there's a social aspect side of it. So it's just sort of like, unfortunately, there's a lot of broken things about our country as great as it is. And yeah, there's just a couple of random thoughts on the whole topic for you.
Yeah, I mean,
I bet he didn't come on the podcast thinking we're going to be talking about
affordable
this.
Housing. But I mean, it's a problem, and there's a lot of people out there that, you know, unfortunately, they, like you said, they talk the most and they scream the most and they're the angriest, but they're also the most uneducated about how this stuff works. You know, they hate capitalism, they think it's awful. But all of us here, I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I think there's always a way to leverage capitalism for social good. Because I think people do want to do good, but if you could tie something into them making money, I mean, look, I mean, people buy treasury bonds and it's, what do you get on that? Like 0.5% right now?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot easier for somebody to go in there and say, hey, I'm going to build this apartment complex and it's going to return 3%, 4%, whatever. Yeah. I'd rather do that.
Tax-free.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, turn it into more of like a, like Kyle said, like a muni bond kind of investment. I think that would be really good. So talk a little bit about the podcast and what got you to want to do the podcast and how long ago did that start?
Yeah, so we launched, I think it was December 30th in 2019. And the idea was, it really came about as house hacking is a niche of real estate investing where you make a slightly different choice with your housing. You know, I've been investing in real estate for quite a while. I had a lot of people say, look, Andrew, I want to learn to do real estate investing because I want to get ahead financially. And then I had other folks that would say, you know, Andrew, I'd love to do real estate, but I just, you know, it's not interesting to me. Is there something I can do in the realm that can help me get ahead a little bit? And my answer for everyone was, you know, go do house hacking. It's a great way to learn about real estate investing to see if it's for you. You get to learn about being a landlord. You get to learn about being a property owner. You get to have reduced or completely eliminated housing costs. And then you can decide, hey, you know what? It's a great tool. I used it for 3 or 4 years to pay off all my student loans or to sock money away from my kid's college account or max out retirement accounts. And now I'm done with it and I'm going to go on to buying more of a traditional family home. And then other folks will say, look, I love this landlord thing. You know, I bought a duplex. I lived in one half. I rented out the other, you know, that other half covered most of my mortgage. I lived for essentially free for 3 years and I love this and I saved up money and I'm going to move out of that duplex and turn it into a long-term rental and I'm going to keep buying investment property. So it really just came about of folks saying like, what's the easiest way to get into real estate investing and what's the sort of easiest way to get ahead? And my answer always was go do house hacking because most folks will spend 25, 30, 35% of their income on housing. So, you know, if you can reduce that line item, cut it in half or completely eliminate it in your budget, it makes it so easy to get ahead.
So when you say house hacking, because we've touched on this in other podcasts, basically what you're doing is you're buying a multifamily and living one of the units, right?
Yes. So there's essentially, I looked at it as six styles, right? So you can buy a single family home and say, look, you know, I'm in my 20s, I'm single, or maybe I'm dating. I don't mind having a bunch of roommates. So go buy or rent a single family home and rent out all the bedrooms. So go buy that, you know, 5-bedroom home out on the fringes. It's not in a horrible part of town, but it's in a decent part. And then you rent out the other 4 rooms to your buddies. You know, you might be bringing in $2,000-$3,000 a month and your mortgage is $1,000, $1,200, $1,400. And now you're pocketing in $1,000 every month on top of getting your mortgage paid. So that's sort of this like roommate style of house hacking. Most folks are familiar with that multifamily. So you buy a duplex, a triplex, or a quad. You know, it's the small multifamily that can qualify for that traditional financing. You live in one unit, you rent out the other. And then the next two styles are sort of similar, but you basically take a single family and make it into a duplex. So, you know, there's the income suite style, sort of what we call it, where maybe you've got that mother-in-law suite or that unfinished basement that you finish and you turn into an income suite. And then the other style is like the ADU house hack or accessory dwelling unit. So maybe you've got that detached garage and you turn the space above the garage into an apartment. So you can rent out that apartment and you can live in the main house. But that idea that ADU or that income suite covers most or all of your mortgage costs. And now again, you know, if you can take your mortgage payment of $1,000, $1,500, $2,000 a month and eliminate it, it just frees up all this other cash. The sort of fifth style is this idea of like a live-in or slow flip. So, you know, everyone's really pretty much familiar with flipping. You know, you buy the house, you fix it up, and you try to sell it as quick as possible so you can bank a bunch of money. But the idea is you buy it where it's in a decent enough shape so you can live in it, get that traditional financing, and then you fix it up over the year to 2 years that you're living in it. A lot of times you live in it for at least a year to meet qualifications for the loan, or you live in it for 2 years. So that way, when you then go to sell it, that appreciation, you're getting tax-free because you get $250 or $500 if you're married in growth on a property, essentially. So it's a great way if you can buy a fixer-upper, you know, buy a property for $200, put $50 in it. At the end of the 2 years, it's worth $400. You know, you're walking away with essentially $150,000 tax-free that you can then go roll into your dream home. So that sort of slow flip, live and flip is that fifth style. And then the sixth one is sort of a little odd and isn't necessarily about buying a property, but pick a career path where you can get a housing allowance. So like on our show, we've interviewed a lot of teachers that have gone abroad to teach. And part of those packages, they provide you with housing or give you a pretty large housing allowance, you know, 15, 20, 25 grand a year for a housing allowance. Or, you know, great example is military. If you're in the military and you're stationed, they give you a housing allowance. You know, a buddy of mine, a guy we had on the show, he was living in San Diego. His housing allowance was $3,000 a month for San Diego.
Damn.
He rented a big house. He had a roommate upstairs. And then downstairs was a finished basement that he rented out on Airbnb. So not only was he using his housing allowance to cover all of his housing, he was pocketing $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month, depending on what was coming in on Airbnb. And he did it all legally with his landlord and he used that housing allowance. But, you know, if you're early in your career or you're getting ready to make a career change, you know, maybe you look at that and say, okay, is there a career field that I'm interested in? And will they provide some sort of housing? You know, travel nurses are another one. They get a housing allowance when they go take a contract in another part of the country. So there's a lot of opportunities out there where work will provide housing for you. And, you know, again, that concept is, can you reduce or eliminate your biggest budget item, which is your housing?
I do have a trivia question and we'll go back to the podcast. So I like all the information we got. Who is the most famous resident of an ADU? Think about it. The most famous person ever to rent the garage or the apartment above the garage of the person's house.
Is this from a TV show?
No, this is real life.
Real life?
Yeah. I know he wasn't famous before a certain incident, but he got super famous.
I don't know. Who?
I mean, we're old enough to remember this. Mr. Cato Kaelin.
No.
Oh, yeah. OJ, he's renting the pool house, right?
Yeah, he's renting the pool house from OJ. That one backfired on OJ. He wasn't a very credible witness.
No. Well, you know what? I heard they passed that law in California. Speaking of California, you mentioned San Diego. I think they just passed a law where you can now build like a tiny house in the back of your backyard and then rent that. And people need to do it in California because the mortgages are ungodly there.
We just interviewed a guy, Joseph, with Neo Builders. He's out in California, Southern California. Him and his brother shifted their company. That's all they do is build those ADUs for folks in California now that that law passed, where it's, again, the simple idea of, you know, going back to sort of housing crisis and that whole conversation, at some point to solve a housing crisis in an area, you got to have denser housing. And I think that's what California realized is, okay, we're getting so far spread out. The only way we can get more people in an area is to have denser zoning. and not everyone wants to have, you know, a 40 unit, 100 unit, 500 unit building next to them. So the simplest solution was let people build those accessory dwelling units on their property. So it's this tiny house, you know, 400, 500, 600 square feet, or you convert that garage into an apartment, or you build that little pool house building in, into its own rental. So yeah, it's a really, really cool process where you can, again, you know, we've had folks that we've interviewed where they bought the single family house that had that garage. They were young, so they lived in that garage apartment, which was 500, 600 square feet, and they rented the big house. And then as they got older in life and they got engaged and got married, they still lived in that house. And then they had a kid, and then they switched. They moved to the big house to raise their family, and they rented that ADU. And this whole time, over this sort of 6, 8, 10 year period, they've had zero housing costs. And it's just this, again, it's this idea of like, can we think of something different on how we do our housing? And it gives us this huge financial benefit.
I think you could do some cool stuff with, containers, the shipping containers, because a lot of people are starting to do that because they stack so neatly. They're pretty secure because they're so heavy that you could have, like, you know, little rows. You have two on the bottom, you stack one in between them, and then you put another one, you get another one. So now you got five of them, just build steps up to the top two.
Now, when you start talking about affordable housing and the way a lot of these advocates are talking about affordable housing, like homeless housing and things like that, I think that works really well because you can turn around and fix one of those up for the purposes that you need them to be temporary housing.
Well, I don't even know that they need to be. I mean, what's between?
Well, for that purpose, yeah, I think it needs to be.
There's nothing. I think they're more durable than a lot of modular homes and mobile homes.
Yeah. If you're going to build it, yeah, you could totally do it. I mean, you could take it to another level.
Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that it's already kind of a structure for temporary housing, I think it makes a lot of sense. And for the reasons you said, they're easy to ship. I mean, the whole logistics infrastructure set up to ship containers.
Yeah, you just put them on a chassis and then you put them in somebody's yard and figure out a way to run plumbing to it. And
boom, done.
Yeah.
So is that a – I got a question for you, Andrew. So yeah. I remember there was people out there – who were doing, they were going and renting apartments in cities for whatever it was. And then they would turn around and Airbnb them. And sometimes they wouldn't tell their landlord, but it was kind of like an Airbnb housing hack.
Yeah. It's just like Airbnb arbitrage thing. So I, as someone that stayed in, you know, short-term rentals, Airbnb, and then also being on the landlord side, like part of me is like, man, that's some ingenuity. And then the other part of me is like, you know, that's just shady as can be, because they do it without telling the landlord, and they're essentially subletting. And pretty much every lease, even commercial leases, have it in on a lot of the times where you can't sublet without the landlord's permission. So, you know, they're turning around and, you know, they say, great, I'm going to rent this apartment for $1,000. We'll throw $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 of furniture in there. And then I'm going to go put it on, you know, Airbnb, and they'll never live there. So the shady part there that I really don't like is, you know, and this I think is a broader sort of business topic. Like, if you build a business on shaky foundation and lies, you know, it's going to come down at some point. And that's what happened to a lot of folks, is they'd lie on the contract. The contract would say they're going to be living there. The contract would say you can't sublet without, and they'd go in and say, well, I don't care. If I get caught, then, you know, what are they going to do? They're going to kick me out. No big deal. So like, I have a little more moral issue with that side of it, but you know, there's folks that were making 40, 50 grand a month. Airbnb caught on to that and got pretty smart, where they had a option where you could do this co-hosting. So you could essentially go to the landlord and say, look, hey, I'm experienced at running, you know, Airbnbs, VRBOs. I want to rent your place. You know, it's renting for $1,000 a month. I'll pay you that $1,000, and then I'll give you a 10% or 15% of my upside. And if someone came to me and wanted to do that for my property, I'd vet them, make sure they had the relevant experience, but I'd have no problem with it all. And Airbnb caught onto that, where they let you have that co-hosting option. So you could cut in the landlord for a little bit of that upside. But I mean, what landlord in the right mind would say no to say like, hey, not only am I going to give you your lease, we're going to screen people even better. I'm going to give you upside. Oh, and by the way, it's going to be cleaned multiple times a month or a week. You know, most of the time in short-term rentals, the properties are kept in better condition than long-term tenants. You know, long-term tenant, they don't want to call and bother you, or they'll forget and they move out 2 or 3 years later and they're like, oh yeah, by the way, that's broken and it's been broken for 2 years. Where with, you know, the short-term tenants, a lot of times you can figure that out really, really quick. And the preventative maintenance I've found is usually a lot better on short-term rentals. And there's always exceptions to that and everything.
But the one thing you do run into beyond just the subletting, the shystiness and shadiness of that son of a bitch making more money than you. we cuss on here. Sorry.
No worries.
Is that you got to deal with the city. So if you're an out of town landlord and all of a sudden you're getting notices from the local governance, hey, you violated our short-term rental. Here's a nice fine of $500. And you get a couple of those. It's like, what the hell just happened?
Yeah.
That's the one thing you got to be
cautious. That's what scares me about Airbnb in investing outside of, like, Cincinnati's pretty cool about it. I think we've got an A-plus rating on
Covington's not anymore.
Covington's not, right. But we got an A-plus rating on AirDNA for Cincinnati. And I think Cleveland does too. Because, you know, we usually catch on to things pretty late here. And, you know, I think now I don't know if they're flirting around with the hotel tax. I know in Covington now they're trying to say, well, you're a hotel, you got to pay us a hotel tax.
And you are.
Yeah, and you are. But Cincinnati, I think, is the regulation is pretty low. But I'm, you know, going into other cities and, you know, that I don't live in and doing this, I'm afraid, you know, some super, an advocate again is going to get on city council or something and complain that, you know, the city's not getting the money from these investors. And, you know, a place like Nashville, I could see it happening in Nashville. Like, I mean, it's getting really expensive in Nashville to buy property and most regular people can't afford to do it. And one of the things I've got that freaks me out a little bit about Airbnb and why it puts a target on their back is that if you buy a property, and I got a buddy who does this, a former Dot Loop guy, and he buys all these beach properties in like Destin and all these places, and they rent them to ball players for like 12 grand a week or something crazy, right?
Yeah.
But he told me, he said, here's the thing. Here's why this is good. He said, because you're buying this property off of a person who lives there now, and it's priced as a single-family property, single-family residence. He said, but when I buy it and I go in and fix it up, and now I have a profitable Airbnb in there, he's like, that property is now a business. It's no longer priced as a single family home. This is priced as a business. So yeah, that $700,000 home I bought on the beach is now worth $1.5 million. Because now you got to factor in all the income that it's producing.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that makes sense. And now for cities like Nashville and places that people like to go, you've got these single family residents that are going up and up and up and up in value. And, you know, somebody who just wants to go down to Nashville and sing and try to make a career of it, they can't afford anything.
We got that same problem here in New Orleans, where a lot of out-of-town folks were buying properties that were single-family homes. And, you know, you could put it on, normal long-term tenant, $1,500, $2,000 a month, Airbnb it. Now you're grossing $5,000 or $6,000. You know, it's something that can contribute to the sort of housing shortage. I see both sides of it, both being, you know, someone that works on the nonprofit side and also being a real estate investor, you know. But to me, there's this underlying business practice here. Not only real estate, is laws and regulations are going to change. We need to be on top of our business and how we invest. So, you know, you could go invest in an area, a city, and do short-term rental, but you better be on top of what's happening in the city, because the laws could change. And then literally overnight, your business could be wiped out. And to me, that doesn't apply just to real estate. Is, you know, look what happened to the taxi industry, right? You know, the cost of the, what do they call them?
Medallions
in New York City were decimated. People were getting, there's finance companies all around helping people buy these. There was, you know, people were buying the medallions for $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. And then Uber came in and decimated that business. You know, to me, it's just a good business practice of you always need to be watching, you know, what's coming up, you know, next year. There could be laws and regulations could change. There could be someone new that's coming into this space to innovate and is going to change things for you. So yeah, I mean, I'm always a little scared doing a play just for short-term rental. I want to make sure the property is going to be good as a long-term rental, or I've got multiple exit strategies. That way, if that short-term rental play changes for some external factor, you know, I've got, you know, my investment covered.
Yeah. Here, it used to be really difficult to get a liquor license. So if you had a space that was going to be mixed use and you're going to have a bar on the bottom or a restaurant that served alcohol, a large chunk of the price of the purchase, and you would try to split it out between the building and then let the business owner buy the liquor license. But it would, at the end, the person who owns the building and the liquor license was getting $65,000 for a liquor license and then whatever for the building at closing. So it didn't matter to them how you split it up. Now they haven't done, like, obviously you still have to get a liquor license, but they've made it so much easier.
So those values got depressed pretty quick.
So now all of a sudden there are a lot more to be had because they're realizing that they're getting employment taxes from these more restaurants, more bars, more employment sales taxes.
Better than the $20,000 you're going to make off of the additional money you were charging before on the liquor license or whatever.
Yeah. So now it's like the liquor license used to be you counted it in your increase in equity of the building because they're not going to make more of these.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're like, yeah, you're right. We're going to make more. We're not going to make it harder to get them. We're going to make it a lot easier. So we may not make more, but whatever we had in reserve, they're out, and we're probably going to make more.
And this brings up a really good point. I mean, real estate investing, and I had a guy come in today, and he was interested in doing some real estate investing. And, it's not, you put the numbers down, right? You think everything's going to go just that way, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to get me a 4-family. It's $200,000. I'll put $40,000 down. I won't have any PMI, I rent each one of these things for $800. I'm going to make $3,200, and my mortgage is going to be $1,000. Boom! I'm gonna profit this much money, and I'll set aside $200 a month for maintenance.
We're doing Cincinnati prices here.
Like, yeah, these are Cincinnati prices.
Yeah, like this isn't like a New Orleans price.
No, not at all. This is west side of Cincinnati prices, my people. So yeah, but you're like, wow, I'm going to cash flow all this money. This sounds like a great idea, right? And even because Cincinnati's so cheap, we've had a lot of New York, Chicago people come in here because they can't get cash flow where they're at. Taxes are ridiculous. Something's weird. I mean, California, for God's sake. I mean, the stuff they're doing to people in California is ridiculous. So, but they're coming here and they're starting to buy up these properties. But people think, oh, this is it. Like, look at these numbers. These look great. There's so many more headaches, so many more things you got to look out for, so many like things you got to look for down the road that could potentially happen. We're talking about the Airbnb thing, but talk a little bit about that. Talk about some of the unknowns that people don't realize when they start writing those numbers down.
Yeah, so I really look at as real estate investing as both an art and a science. So what you were really referring to, these folks come in and really look at it from the science standpoint. It's like, I'm going to do the analysis and I'm going to run my numbers. And be like, great, the mortgage is $1,000 and I can bring in $3,200. Awesome. I'm going to profit $2,200 a month. So I'll set aside $200. So a lot of folks, they'll make the mistake on that science side of doing the numbers where they don't include all the stuff in, right? So they say, oh, great, I'll put aside $200 a month. That'll cover my maintenance. But they forget about CapEx. Or they say, oh, the roof, the inspector said it's fine, so I'm not setting aside money for my CapEx. And most folks won't realize, like, hey, you're going to have some expenses that are going to come up that can be $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 or more. And, maybe you'll dump the property before then, but really you should be setting aside a lot more money. So, you've got your maintenance, you've got your CapEx. Like, if you have a HVAC system go out, a condenser go out, those can be big things. Even folks make mistakes with the maintenance, right? I mean, you're setting aside $200 a month, but you have a fridge go out, even a cheap fridge, you're spending $600. So there goes 3 months of maintenance. And that's if it's not a little nicer of a place where a fridge can run you $800 or $1,000. So there's a lot of very small expenses that can blow that maintenance budget. So I see a lot of folks mess up that data science side of not accurately looking at maintenance, not breaking the building down to see what the big CapEx expenses are going to be. A lot of folks will underwrite and not include taxes the right way. So they'll say, the tax bill this year is $1,200. So I'll put aside $100 a month. But the property hasn't been reassessed in 7 years and they're about to do a tax assessment this coming year. And guess what? Now the property tax bill is about to double. So a lot of folks will forget that and really not do a good job looking forward about what are potential changes that are coming. And then the art side is, great, we ran the numbers, looks good, but did you know the turnover in that side of town or in that area? You know, these are more higher touch tenants. They have a, it's harder to get a property manager for this tenant base. Like when I did affordable housing, getting property managers to do that was near impossible. You know, folks didn't want to do it because it was extremely high touch. You know, tenants were a lot harder on the unit. So you might say, well, hey, you know, online, Bigger Pocket said, you know, 5-8% people in the forum said that's fine. Well, did you know in affordable housing, you might be way, way over that. You know, you don't have to do marble countertops, but you're going to have a lot of stuff turn over a lot quicker. So a lot of folks will not understand the art side of real estate investing and really look at it from that person side of things, the human side of things, where they only concentrate on the numbers and not realize like, this is a people business. I've got to interact with contractors. I've got to interact with realtors. Even if you put in a property manager, you know, you want to check in with your property manager. You just don't want to forget it. Are they doing a good job? Are they doing the things the way they should? So, you know, my really big approach when folks tell me they want to get into real estate investing, I was like, look, it's both an art and a science. And you need to figure out, can you do both sides of it? And if not, you got to bring someone on your team that can help you think through the part that you're not good at, because it's not purely just an analysis running the number side of things, which a lot of folks do.
Yeah, I had about 10 years ago, I had a guy, and it's not just the tenant you have to worry about. Sometimes it's the property manager. I had a guy, he just up and left and took everybody he managed, all their property for an entire month, and just ran off.
Yeah,
disappeared.
Somebody I'm really close to, not me, but my property manager kind of flaked out on me, but it wasn't that bad. But he had like 5 properties, and it was like he wasn't paying attention. It was 5 months worth of rents that were just gone. And the guy was still in town. It wasn't like he took off. But what I wanted to say with the house hacking part of it, built-in benefit of living in the property is that you've got real-time data on how shitty or how great your tenant is. So you know there's a whole bunch of noises upstairs, or there's animals when there shouldn't be animals, or you got all this other stuff, as opposed to the once-a-month visit from the property manager who has to announce in 24 hours.
If they do the once-a-month visit.
Right, but they still have to announce. If they're on their P's and Q's, they still have to announce 24 hours in advance, hey, I'm going to be there tomorrow, giving them ample time to get rid of a dog or ample time to get rid of a cat and ample time to get rid of the drugs and everything else that they shouldn't be in there.
Their cousin who just got out of jail who's living there? Yeah, I've had that happen.
But that's the thing that I like about the house hack, is that your boots are on the ground. Your eyes are, you know, open. You see what's going on. So you can always, if you want to hire the property manager to be your interface because you don't want to deal with the person that lives right next door to you. I mean, that to me, that's how I would have to do it. Not out of fear, but out of like, I would give in the sob stories too easily. I need that guy to be, that guy or lady, and man or woman to.
I've fallen victim to that. Yeah.
I need that person to be the toughie.
And that's the thing that I love about house hacking, right? Is you get to experience it firsthand. So even if you have a property manager, you start to understand what they go through, and that makes you better at managing your property manager. Because if folks get in trouble with that is they don't manage the property manager. They don't know how, or they don't understand what the property manager goes through. So, yeah, I mean, to me, house hacking is a perfect way to learn about real estate investing. And then you might come back after 2 years and be like, crap, this isn't for me. I want to get out of this real estate game. Or you might realize, hey, I'm going to go all in on this.
Yeah, going in all in on, if you got a great property manager, makes all the difference in the world. Your experience is a million times better. Yeah. If you're the one that has to deal with all the kooks and all the late night phone calls, and even if you have great tenants, I mean, we love drama here. So we love to talk about the beat up units and the guys that steal your.
Oh, my units, you mean? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're,
but, oh, dude, if you ever want to lose faith in humanity,
put cages on your condensers.
Oh, well, I've had a guy walk off with a condenser one time, the entire condensing unit, just lifted it up and started walking down the street with it. Because here's the problem. And we talk about, you got to do your research. I bought a house right around the corner from Recycle Center.
They
so every crackhead in the neighborhood would just come over to my house and use it for a place to make money. And as soon as I put a for rent, I learned not to put for rent signs out. You can't put for rent signs out. Yeah, they know it's empty, right? So they would just come. The guy goes there on Sunday. Goes on a Sunday. Just picks up the condenser and just starts walking it down the street. Police pick him up. drive him to my house, find out, you know, look on the auditor site, finds out where I live, drives to my house, says, do you know this guy? I said, no. He said, he told you, or he told us that you said he could have the condensing unit on the side of your house. I'm like, why would I do that? So they take him off to jail, right? He gets out of jail on a Thursday The reason the cops came is because my neighbor saw him doing it, right? Yeah. You know, it's not easy. I mean, you got to take it off and everything else. It's going to take a second. Anyway, he gets out of jail on a Thursday, goes back to my house, breaks in the basement, doesn't turn the water off, steals all the copper out of the basement and the A coil out of the furnace. Same thing. Neighbor saw him, calls the cops, but that time they didn't catch him. He was out, probably just took it right down to the recycle center and got $15 for it. Did $7,000 worth of damage.
Yeah.
And it's not even them. It's not just that. Like, then the people I had living in there prior to that, essentially what they do is they'll move in, they'll give you the deposit, they'll give you a first month's rent. And if they're not on Section 8, these are regular people that just are in a bad neighborhood, right? Section 8 holds people somewhat accountable. But these like regular people who are in a, you know, the neighborhood I grew up in, they have all kinds of little tricks that they'll pull on you so that they don't have to pay rent. And they'll move in there, they'll give you the first month, you'll think they're going to pay, and then all of a sudden they won't pay 1 month, they'll give you the sob stories, right? If you're managing the property yourself, and you're like, man, I just moved these people in, like, I don't want to already have to evict them. So you're like, let me let them slide for a month, right? So then they get 2 months behind, then you evict them, now it's another month, right? So yeah. You might have got, you know, first month's rent or whatever, yeah, tenant. And then you got to clean it, because then before they leave, they destroy it because you evicted them. Because you're a bad person, right? So you evict them, and now they destroy everything. So now you got, you know, $5,000-$6,000 worth of damage. I had a guy, we evicted him after 2 months, took a golf club and beat all of the walls in the house. Didn't leave one wall untouched. Beat up the stove, the refrigerator, you name it. Just beat the crap out of everything. And you know, of course, the insurance comes out, and, you know, they depreciate everything, and you don't get from the insurance company what it's going to cost to actually fix it up. So now you're in the hole.
Not without a battle. Not without a good contractor.
No. And the guy just takes off, and, you know, who knows where he went.
So the lesson in this, boys and girls, is vet the area that you're investing in, that you're going to look to house hack in. Vet your tenants. Vet your property manager. And then you'll have a much better experience than Mr. Kaler.
The lesson is, if you feel sorry for everybody, and you come from this little suburban bubble, you grew up in a cul-de-sac, mommy and daddy took care of you, you never had a problem in your life, you got Christmas presents, both parents, all that good stuff, right? And now you're this, like, voice for the common man.
Why the Christmas presents? Why did you throw that in?
Because I didn't get good Christmas. Like, we got nothing, right? So, like, you know, the people that got everything they ever asked for when they were kids, right?
Yeah, but Christmas presents?
Yeah, we got a little bit of stuff, but not much. Like, we'd usually share stuff. So, you know, those people, now all of a sudden they're telling me, somebody who grew up in that kind of environment, or actually, and then tried to help people by giving them affordable housing to live in. Now I'm the bad person, and they have no skin in the game, right? If you want to really understand what's going on, seriously, get a property in a bad neighborhood and rent it out.
Can you tell what triggers Adam?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, telling you, I mean, you've done it. Tough, Andrew, yeah. You've been there. I'm sure you've been there. And I mean, it will change the way you look at the world.
Yeah. You know, the approach that I always took, you know, and I was fortunate where I had a lot of international development experience, but I would be the nice guy. So like North Carolina, it was pretty easy to evict in a sense, but, you know, rent's due on the first, you could deliver the late notice. I think it was the third or the fifth. I would still deliver the late notice on the fifth. If, say, their paycheck was on Friday the 7th, I'd say, no problem. Here's the late notice. So you're welcome to pay on the 7th. We'll stop, you know, going through the whole process, but I'm going to make sure they got the pay or quit notice. That way, if the 7th came around, then I could still move forward with filing eviction. And then if they paid on the 7th, I'd waive the late charge for them because I knew they were paycheck to paycheck. But I always tried to cover my bases in the sense of, you know, I document everything, I'd follow the notices, and then I could sort of, you know, pull the ripcord and stop the process if they came through. Half the time folks would come through, half the time they wouldn't, but I was already in the process. So I made the mistake once of being too nice, and then I learned, hey, I can be firm and be nice, but I'm going to make sure I'm covered and going through the process and getting that ball rolling in case, you know, they are giving me the sob story.
So do you cover this on your podcast? How to deal with tenants and how to, like Adam said, like it's not quite as dramatic as a bunch of suburban kids that don't know anything about life, but some people have no experience dealing, like managing other people. And basically when you're a landlord, you kind of are managing other people's behaviors, because you set rules, regulate, you set your rules and your precedent, and like, this is what I'm going to accept. This is my property. This is what you can do here. This is what you can't do here. So do you like kind of give an education crash course of like when you guys are looking to do this? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We really talk about like pick the style that's best for you. So like, you know, out of those six styles, which one's going to be best for where you're at in life? Then we sort of dive into, okay, what's the type of tenant? So, you know, affordable housing, student housing, senior housing, you know, luxury housing, you know, what fits best with you. Then we also go into a bit about the type and length of tenancy. So, you know, if you're super social, you're outgoing and you like constant change, you know, doing short-term rental could be good for you. Or maybe you want to look at the midterm rental. So like, you know, we've got our old Airbnb guest house. We changed into renting to travel nurses. So they usually stay 3 months at a time. So you could do that sort of midterm tenant, which is like corporate housing or travel nurses, or you could do the long-term tenant. So we'll really talk about, you know, picking the style, the length of tenancy, the geographic area, the asset class, and mixing and matching that to where you're at in life and your personality and your style. And that'll help you be as successful as possible. So, you know, if you've got a social working background, maybe you've done international aid work like me, and, you know, affordable housing, you could be really good at it. And for other folks, you know, it's the farthest thing from there. Some folks that maybe will do that roommate style, the idea of having strangers come in their home for Airbnb just, you know, is frightening for them. Where other folks are like, man, if I could have someone come in every single week that's different, that I could be meeting from all around the world, that would be so cool. So we sort of dive into looking at all those pieces, and, you know, the case studies that we do when we interview folks is we touch on those, and they can say like, hey, this worked for me, or this didn't, and that's how I got to doing this place, and that's how I ended up at that style, and use those as sort of lessons learned from folks that want to do a house hack, and so they can really customize it for them and have the most, you know, chance for being successful.
So if I come to you, Andrew, and I say, I really am interested in this house hack, is it like from listing to tenant, or do you say, all right, great, you know, these are the types of properties you want to look for. Once you have the property, come back to me and I'll help you set this up the right way.
Yeah. So we have a free 6-step, you know, quick start guide that sort of says like, here's the 6 major steps to doing a house hack, getting you from start to finish. It's one of our sort of, you know, free downloads we have on our website. And it sort of goes through the best practices of, you know, step 1, step 2, step 3, all the way to the last step of great, you know, you own the property. It's time to go through tenants. Are you going to manage? Are you going to self-manage? And then, you know, we have that built out and branch out to, I think we've got about 180, 190 articles on our website. We've got 50 podcast episodes and then another almost 50 written case studies. So if someone says, great, you know, I think I like this house hacking style, we can say, great, you know, here's 3 written case studies and 10 interviews on a podcast. Listen to a couple of them and make sure that's the right fit for you. Okay, on the, you know, step 2, now you need to find a good realtor and build out your team. Well, you know, here's an interview with a realtor, you know, here's a bunch of articles around it. So we try to cater it all the way through as sort of a self-serve, you know, free options.
So for this,
getting them from idea to closing on a house and managing tenants.
So once they get tenants, do you have on your platform the ability for them to do like their profits and losses, their rent rolls and everything? Or do you like just say this is a example, go here. This is probably your best program, your downloadable program for self-management.
Yeah. So we've got a couple of recommendations on property management software that they can do. We'll actually have here coming out in the spring. We've got interviews with several founders of property management companies. That way we can say, look, you know, here's, you know, five of the best tools for small landlords. And by the way, you know, here's interviews with the founders so you can understand the company culture and all the benefits of it. And that way folks can sort of choose where they're at. Because even on the property management side, if you're going to self-manage, there's a lot of property management softwares that can be like truly do it yourself to, you know, partially doing it yourself to fully outsourcing it and sort of everywhere in between. So yeah, we try to give recommendations and tools for them to help them figure out what's going to be best for them to go with.
Wow. I think there's a lot to this, and I don't want people to get scared off by my horror stories, because I think this really is a way for a lot of people to build wealth. I think this is probably the best way. You know, if you're not, you know, into day trading the stock market, or, you know, you're not, you didn't get in on cryptocurrency a long time ago. I mean, this is probably one of the tried and true best ways to do it. It's just make sure you do your research, you know. Unfortunately, the way I did it was is I started buying property in the neighborhood I'm from, and people are vindictive there. And if you are firm on them, then they'll be more firm. Yeah. But that's, you get tenants like that sometimes. And I think, you know, people need to understand that, you know, there's ways to do things, there's ways not to do things. And sometimes you live and you learn, but there's ways to avoid mistakes. And I think by taking a course like what you offer, or, you know, learning from people who, you know, even bigger pockets and things like that, those are ways to do things the right way. So I don't want anybody to get scared off by this, because I think if you really want to build wealth and you want to build financial freedom over time, especially if you're young and you get in on this, I mean, you got in on this when you were in your 20s, so did I. But this is one of the best ways in America to make money.
Yeah.
And residual money that just keeps happening. And you're building wealth, you're building money on the equity that you gain in the home. But then you're hopefully cash flowing enough that you can maintain that home, maybe put a little something in your pocket every month. And like you said, you know, maybe not even have to pay a mortgage. Like you completely eliminate your monthly expense for housing.
That's the goal, right?
That is the goal. Well, Andrew, give us some links or some ways for people to reach out to you or at least listen to the podcast.
Yeah. So the podcast is The House Hacking Podcast. You know, you can find it everywhere: Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. Just do House Hacking Podcast and we'll come up. And then websites, FIBYREI.com. And if you go to up in the top right, there's our little cheat sheet link that you can click on and download our free guide.
Awesome.
That's a great name for a podcast. I can't believe it was available.
I know. I was thinking of the idea and I was like, no one actually took this already? Done. So.
Well, we got a great idea too. And we do. And I couldn't believe nobody took this name either, but they didn't. Adam has a huge parking lot here that, I don't know, are we zoned yet?
No. I don't think so. But I mean, I don't think it'd be a problem. It's Kentucky, man. You don't even, it's fine.
Anyway, we're going to, just for, you know, vacation money for the year, we're going to rent out. We're going to go purchase two dump trailers, potentially three. These hydraulic dump trailers you can pull in the back of a 4x4 that, you know, roofers or small contractors can use. And then they can dump it at their waste site or whatever and bring it back to us, hopefully clean, hopefully with tires still attached. But we were looking for a name, and Adam came up with a great name kind of as a joke. And I thought, well, somebody had to have used this before. But in the state of Kentucky, they have not. Are you ready for this? This is the best name in the history of the world. So our dump truck company is going to be called Take a Dump.
Trailer. Awesome.
Nobody had it.
I've already got the commercials. I have three kids. They're in. They're going to be this. They're going to be the actors in it.
But yeah, I keep telling everybody the opportunity cost of money. Like if I wanted to go buy a four family, like over on the west side, the $200,000 four family, I don't want to pay PMI. I put $40,000 down, right? 20%.
Yeah.
Well, we could go out and buy one of these dump trailers, and based on what our research and what, you know, there's a guy on YouTube who's done it down in Georgia. He's making about $50,000 per dump trailer, and these dump trailers are about 10 grand. So if you think about the opportunity cost of money, I could go buy one four family and lock up my $40,000, or I can go buy four dump trailers and make $200,000 a year. And I mean, I don't know how.
I don't think we'll make that, but I because we're not going. We're not doing all the service.
We're gonna have to do a lot of advertising too.
Well, we're not doing this. Well, that's what you're there for.
But I always wanted a business I could put like a banner on, like the outfield wall at the Cincinnati Reds Stadium.
Oh my God.
You know, I can't do that with like my businesses now.
Hit it here and take a free dump.
Yeah. Yeah. Hit it here. Yeah.
There's this Port-A-John company. I forget their name down here in New Orleans, but their tagline is our business stinks, but it's picking up.
Ah, love it. Yeah, I'll tell them.
AJ Jolly, the plumbing company, not AJ Jolly. That's the park that their family gave up. It's Jolly Plumbing. A full house beats a flush beats a full house on the back of their car.
A straight flush beats a full house. Yeah.
I'm just telling you, man, like we're renting dump trailers for Christ's sake.
And this is the industry you could play around and be crazy.
It's not like we're like going to be financial advisors. This is all, I think it's hilarious.
It's rental property adjacent, right? It's like, you know, people that are rehabbing, people that are doing updating the houses, people that are flipping, they're going to need these things.
Well, I mean, and it's catchy. Even people that think it's a disgusting name are going to be like, take a dump. I can't believe my name. So whenever they think of like, oh my God, I need a dump trailer. What am I going to do? Oh, I hate that company, but take a dump. It's the only
one
I know.
It's a sticky thing, right? It gets you.
Yeah. I hate those guys. I hate those guys for the name, but it's the only one I could think of. I'm going to call them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Andrew, I appreciate your time today. This has been awesome. And, good luck with the podcast. Good luck with your real estate investing and hopefully your wife sticks around and puts up with all this stuff. My wife's this stresses her out. I don't know how she deals with it.
Yeah, luckily my wife says it's my thing, and as long as it doesn't bug her, I can keep rolling with it. So
She's a good woman.
Yeah.
All right,
definitely,
sir.
A keeper.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks, guys.
I can't wait to download the podcast. You're gonna have another one. Maybe I'll bump you into the top 4%.
Oh, awesome. Appreciate it.
All right, Andrew. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, guys.
See ya.